This is the third Dharma talk on the topic of the Eightfold Path. We're doing one a month through May of 2019. And tonight's talk is on wise speech. I want to start by clarifying what speech means. It's communication of all types. Morse code, semaphore flags, or even the internet, and facial expressions, like the one I just made. And, of course, body language. Now, let's look at where wise speech fits in the Eightfold Path. It's the first part of a series on ethics. And we come to it after spending a month each on wise understanding and wise intention. The entire path is meant to guide us to where we can drop the mental habits that cause our lives to be pervaded with suffering. It's not nonstop, but it's pretty pervasive. And what I'm talking about are the fears, the doubts, the dislikes, the angers, resentments, regrets, etc., etc., and of course, craving, from preference to desire to full-fledged addiction. These mental habits arise from wrong views or wrong understanding. They come from misunderstanding the truth of how things are and how they work. The path is a lifelong exercise in watching what's wrong, in studying our dukkha, our suffering. Not with the intention of changing it through our willpower or blaming ourselves, but really growing deeply into an understanding of the causes and effects of dukkha as we watch our minds work. Our job is to experience the third noble truth each time it plays out, understanding more and more deeply that the cause of dukkha is clinging. That's the third noble truth. Clinging, as I indicated before, comes in the form of either craving or aversion. And we study it causing dukkha so that we can feel the burn of clinging to the hot coal of suffering. So we're clinging to those mental habits that cause the suffering. And then, after we study this over and over, it isn't through willpower, but the innate desire of our entire being that will just let go of that burning coal. Now, that may have sounded like fire and brimstone, but here's the reason why it doesn't need to be. Kindness. The intention to reduce suffering is also called simply kindness. So with wise understanding, we came to understand basically that it's about dukkha. And then the intention is to reduce suffering. And you put that into the positive, and it's the intention to be kind. It's the cornerstone of our practice. The wise intention that we just studied. And the Dalai Lama said, my religion is simple. My religion is kindness. Apply it first and foremost to yourself. This suffering lab specimen that you're studying in your practice. Be kind to you. And then, of course, apply it to all other beings. In a nutshell, that is the ethics section of the Eightfold Path. Many of us balk at the thought of being kind to ourselves, thinking that it's selfish, like we should only be kind to others. But we and others are the same. And we can't truly be kind to either without being kind to both. And pragmatically, we have to put on our own oxygen mask first before we can help others. And without holding in mind that all beings suffer, and feeling compassion for all of us, we can't open ourselves to the exploratory surgery that is needed to clearly understand the causes and nature of our suffering. Kindness is our anesthetic as we do this practice. Surgeons want to help. They don't want to torture while they're at it. So they have an anesthetic. And so do we in this practice, being kind to ourselves. So that about sums it up. Thank you. No, seriously, there is more to say, and in fact, it's so much that I spent most of the last several days working on this talk, trying to decide what I could eliminate. First, let's review the relevant teachings, such as the sutta that was cited by Bhikkhu Bodhi, called Instructions to Rahula at Mango Grove. And that, for those of you who like to note sutta numbers, number 61 of the Majjhima Nikaya. Rahula, by the way, is the Buddha's son. And he was telling his young son, whenever you want to do a verbal action, you should reflect on it. This verbal action I want to do, would it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Would it be an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results? If on reflection you know that it would, then any verbal action of that sort is absolutely unfit for you to do. But if on reflection you know that it would not cause affliction, that it would be a skillful verbal action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then any verbal action of that sort is fit for you to do. So it's about kindness. I'm trying to remember the acronym that a friend of mine came up with for this reflection the Buddha's talking about, and it was WIMO, or Why Is My Mouth Open? It should be for a kind reason. However, you may see a problem with the Buddha's approach, especially if you've ever tried to practice with wise speech. Reflecting this way, unless you've practiced a lot, it's quite difficult in the rush of most of our conversation. It happens really quickly. Also, how do we know in advance if it's going to cause affliction? Now, experience helps. Just do this practice, you watch the result, you get some sort of a feeling. But I still often find that no matter how careful I am, people still misunderstand what I've said. Maybe they didn't hear the not in a sentence, or their minds just fuzzed out on parts of what I said. Or maybe they don't know I'm joking. So it's good that there are guidelines for wise speech. With all of the parts of ethics, including action and livelihood, which we'll get to next month and the month after, it's always about the intention not to harm. But it also does help to have these signposts to follow. The Vacca Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, number 5.198, says, "A statement endowed with five factors is well-spoken and blameless." What are those five factors? It's spoken at the right time. It's spoken in truth, politely, beneficially, and with a mind of goodwill. Various other suttas yield four guidelines, the ones that are discussed by Bhikkhu Bodhi: abstaining from speech that is false, slanderous, harsh, and idle chatter. And then there's the school that I belong to that has four tests. And they're stated in positive language, and that's why I like them. Our communications are less likely to cause suffering if they're truthful, kind, helpful, and appropriate. Truth, obviously, is a big one. It's essential for seeing things as they truly are, which is the whole point of mindfulness. Gil Fronsdale says, "Truthfulness is mindfulness out loud." Can you imagine what goes through your mind as you're meditating if there was a speaker or an ASL interpreter sharing that with the world? How do we really know what's true? Maybe someone we trust said it. Maybe we've seen evidence supporting it. Or we're taking it on faith. Maybe we've really just believed it for so long that it seems like unassailable truth to us. So however we got that bit of information, how do we communicate it and guard truthfulness, honesty? Well, in the Chanka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 95, we're told basically to state our sources, like good journalists, lawyers, scholars, or Dharma teachers. We say, well, I read in the New Yorker that X, Y, and Z. Or, well, I've always thought X, Y, and Z. When I was preparing to go to law school and learning about citations, I thought that having to do that for all of the statements I made would weaken my arguments, my assertions, especially when the sources were a little bit squishy. But I realized that if I did it regularly and admitted when the sources were squishy, that what I said would have more solidity, a trustworthiness. And that offers safety to everyone involved. Another part of the discipline of citing our sources is to just not say something if we don't know where we got the idea, and definitely if we're aware it's not true. Well, every student asks me, what about white lies? This is the gotcha question that teachers just love. White lies are also known as social fibbing. So the answer is, ask yourself why you want to say anything other than what you really believe to be true. A big one is fear of social consequences. Maybe it'll make someone mad or hurt their feelings. In a Dharma talk, Gil Fronsdell gave a hypothetical example of a bride wearing her wedding dress before the wedding, who asks you if you like the dress. And you happen to think it's hideous. Gil suggests that you might say, you look lovely in it. I often officiate at weddings, and I've seen a lot of dresses that I would never buy, but I can honestly tell every bride that she looks radiant, because they all have. There are ways to avoid being brutally honest, but please don't feel that you have to be creative each time. We can look for ways to speak the truth kindly without saying something that seems untrue to us. And if we can't think fast enough to be suave, then we can stick with saying as little as possible. Maybe just a big smile. When we find ourselves in a group that's gossiping, we don't really need to take part. I tend to stay silent or wander away. But how do we know what's gossip and what's needed information about someone? Well, check your feelings. Check your motivations before talking about someone who isn't there. Mentally double check if saying this really will be helpful and to whom. Will it strengthen the group's cohesion or damage it and possibly the person being discussed? And are you sure that you've picked the right audience to give information to about someone else? If it's at work, are you following the protocols for tattling on someone? You can test if it's wise speech by asking yourself how you'd feel if the person you're talking about overheard what you say. Chris Clifford, one of the people giving this course at IMC, tells a story of someone who asked a group gossiping about the habits of an absent man, "I wonder why he does that." That question took the negative energy right out of the group's chatter. Gossip is a complex and challenging issue, and it's worth lots of mindful investigation. So there isn't always an answer that I can put out there and you can take to deal with white lies or gossip. We learn as we go. That's kind of how it works. I think the best way to know if our words in any situation are motivated by kindness or a desire to help is to be in touch with the physical feelings of our emotions. And that's why I dealt with that in the instructions for tonight's meditation. For most of us, kindness has an expansive, positive feeling. But if our words are coming from our own ego needs or from animosity, we're probably feeling tense, maybe burning or jagged sensations. I don't mean to put sensations into your mind, but there really is a difference. The way we get to know how we feel is to practice mindfully watching. Once we can watch our physical feelings of any sort, then we can learn what mind states are associated with those various sensations. The real trick is getting in touch with them. Besides during conversations that we have, the other really good opportunity to do this, observing our physical emotions, is during meditation. In that moment when we realize that thoughts have distracted us from mindfulness, there are traces of feeling associated with those thoughts. So practice looking for them. If you haven't seen it yet, just keep trying to remember, what am I feeling? Those feelings may be much fainter during meditation than they would be during a conversation, especially if it's a heated one. But it's during meditation that you have the time and the mindfulness to investigate those feelings more closely. Many teachings about wise speech deal with what's called idle talk. All societies have their ways of, for example, greeting people. I knew ahead of time that the usual greeting in Thailand was quite different than ours. But I was still thrown when the first person asked me if I had eaten. That's like our asking each other how we are. There's no special desire to know the details, but it's a way to quickly express goodwill and a quick bonding exercise. But imagine a long conversation at that level. Chris Clifford points out that it can really be exhausting to stay superficial. Also, this idle chat is an environment that supports the development of gossip and harsh speech, like email and social media. Clearly, harsh speech isn't kind or helpful, and it's very rarely appropriate. It may feel good for a quick minute to vent or insult or criticize someone, but it most likely feels unpleasant to the recipient. How have you felt when being yelled at or insulted or criticized? Even when I know that harsh words are the result of a misunderstanding, it's upsetting to have them aimed at me. It takes a lot of skill not to retaliate at the speaker's level. Also, body language, tone of voice, and facial expressions are very powerful forms of communication, even when we display them unconsciously. They can convey ill will and become the entire content of what is heard. Moving on to another form of appropriate, knowing when to say something, however true, kind, or helpful, is also important. We can't ever know with certainty how our message will be received, but there are times when we can know that it's inappropriate. Maybe some event is looming that will change the circumstances around what we're about to say. Or we may want to add more criticism even after someone has already apologized, or provide important information at a time when our listeners are clearly too upset to take in the meaning. Humor can also be a minefield, and it frequently leads to inappropriate speech because what makes jokes funny is that they aren't completely true. Jokes are often aimed at people, the butts of the joke. And when the jokes are flying, they can develop into gratuitous sarcasm or profanity. Besides what we say, there are other important aspects of speech. And I may have already indicated a very important aspect of wise speech is wise listening. And we do this to honor the person who's revealing themselves and to absorb the information they're trying to give us. If we spend the time when others are talking with other thoughts swirling around in our heads, we may never absorb what they're trying to communicate. And just for your information, I gave a talk called Wise Listening on April 23rd of 2017. Finally, last but definitely not least, we need to listen to our internal speech. It can torment us without our realizing it. Our mental chatter can drag us repeatedly through past traumas or criticize us harshly for small or innocent mistakes. We can demand things of ourselves that we'd never ask of others. I've heard people say, if anyone else talked to me the way I talk to myself, I would never speak to them again. We need to use wise speech with ourselves. We are not fair game just because no one else can hear. If we practice really listening to ourselves as well as others, then whether or not we like what we hear, we'll learn a lot that can make our lives better. So I have tried to craft practice guides that will lead you through seeing all of the elements of wise speech. And they're on the handout that's next to the Donna basket. These practice guides, there are three of them, because we only have 3 weeks to conquer wise speech. I'm kidding. We're just practicing with it. So please bear in mind that these exercises are intended to help you develop mindfulness skills for dealing with wise speech that is part of a lifelong practice. And they will gradually make your communications more beneficial for you and others. So, thank you.